In ancient India, the universe was conceived of and structured and understood in a very logical, organized way. And so space and time, history, social structure, hierarchy, and so on. This world, the next world, everything was logically ordered, at least with a lot of internal coherence and consistency. And a lot of this this conception, a lot of the structure is somewhat universal in the sense that although in India there's a tremendous variety of different traditions and different approaches to religiosity, spirituality, and this life, still there's widespread agreement, even outside Hinduism, say in Buddhist traditions and so on, there's widespread agreement. So this is kind of like the universal picture of the universe. Space, time, human life, and so on. But you find for a lot of Indian history. So I want to go over that so everybody's in the, so to speak, the same ballpark. And this is also the material that's covered in a lot of this in the first two chapters of textbook Introducing Hinduism. So where do I begin? Well, karma. We'll talk about the law of karma first, because that's something which almost everybody in India accepted. And the word karma, of course, the Sanskrit word comes from the Sanskrit root kurm. It's pronounced something like the English word kur, as in you kur. So, and or sometimes pronounced like kri. So in English, we still have cognate words, words that are linguistically related to this, such as create. Create or increase, those words are actually cognate in the Sanskrit root kri. Sanskrit is an Indo-European language. We're going to talk a lot in a little while about what that means, about the proto-historical connection between Western civilization and Indian civilization, a very deep and profound connection, family connection, which is manifested, among other places, in the language. Anyway, so together with the word karma, actually, for a complete concept, there's also the Sanskrit word samsara. These things, I'm sure, in the textbook. Samsara means the idea, basically, that we reincarnate. In the literal sense of the word, carne, you know, the Latin word carne, flesh, as in non-vegetarian foods like chili con carne. So, the idea is that we are souls. And this is something which is almost a universal Hindu idea. And even groups that were, let's say, attacked Hinduism philosophically, like Buddhism, they often define themselves as the non-soul people, anatman. We'll talk a lot about Buddhism and Buddhist philosophy. But in any case, the idea is that there's a soul in the body. The body is more or less like a garment. It's like clothes. We wear this body just as we wear our clothes. And the classical statement of this is given in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, where Krishna says, in Sanskrit, give you an idea what it sounds like, Vasansi Jirnani Jatavihaya. Just as when with worn-out clothes, and the word for worn-out is jirna, like English gerontology and so on, aging. So, Vasansi Jirnani, just as we give up worn-out clothes, and we accept new clothes. Anyani Sanyati Parani Dehi. So in the same way, we give up bodies. Bodies are like clothes. They wear out. We give up bodies. We take new bodies. So this process is called samsara. Sara means sort of like moving, wandering, and sang means around, wandering around the universe. Now, this samsara, this migrating or wandering around the universe, doesn't only take place on Earth. It takes place on many planets throughout the universe. Now, that samsara, karma, is a law, according to this way of thinking, that we do not take new lives. We don't enter new bodies whimsically or, by chance. But actually, there are laws governing. There are laws governing what body you take in your next life. And these are essentially moral laws. They're moral laws that also take into consideration your preferences. In other words, if you like, let's say, for example, you're really into music, then in your next life you may continue that musical proclivity. So there are, you could say, propensities. There are, the law of karma governs certain propensities. There's a certain continuity The idea being that although we leave one physical body and accept another physical body, our mental body, this is the idea, there are actually two bodies. There's the physical body, but there's also a mental body called Linga, Rupa Sharira. Anyway, so the idea is that the soul, within this mental body, which is your mind, the sum total of all your thoughts and feelings and so on, your mind goes with you to your next body. That's why there's continuity in your next life. So, for example, what we might call irrational phobias, like, let's say, you know, fear like claustrophobia or agoraphobia, or this phobia, that phobia. Phobia generally means an irrational fear of high places, but actually, according to this karma, you might say it's not entirely an irrational fear, because if in your last life, let's say you fell off the Empire State Building, then in this life, you may not be inclined to go to the top of high buildings. So it looks to the world like an irrational phobia, but it may just be what is called in the yoga system. We'll talk about everything later. But in yoga, one great scholar of the 20th century, Iliadi, who was one of the pioneers, actually, of the academic study of religion in the West, he said that India was the first civilization to really come up with a serious depth psychology, going very deeply into our psychology, so that we have sankskaras, which we'll talk about later. Fears, deep-rooted fears or desires or expectations, which are a sort of a mental continuity from our previous life. So anyway, apart from that continuity, there are moral laws. If you do good things, you get good things. You know, bad deeds are rewarded with punishment and so on. So that this problem of justice in the universe, is there justice in the universe? Our search for cosmic justice is not confined to a single lifetime. Like say, in the book of Job in the Old Testament, where you have to find God's justice within one lifetime. But throughout many lifetimes, good and evil deeds are rewarded and punished. So that's karma, samsara. And now, there are also four purusha arthas. Purusha means person in Sanskrit. It often means a male person, or it can just mean person. And it's often used in examples, like when a person does this, that happens. So often just talking about people in general, they use it for purusha. Anyway, so artha means purpose or goal. So purusharthas are, again, these are very almost universal conceptions within Indian history. The idea is there are four goals of human life. One goal is dharma. We'll talk more about this word dharma, or virtue. I'll just call it virtue for now, and then in a second we'll talk more about this very important word, dharma. In other words, human life is meant to cultivate virtue. We should try to be good people. Not only because we'll get good karma from that, but because, as they say, virtue is its own reward. So we should cultivate virtue. Now, apart from cultivating virtue, you also have to take care of yourself. You have to, you know, watch out for yourself and your family. You have to earn money. You've got to, so all the things we do, keeping our health insurance up, and keeping our bills paid, getting a good job, just watching out for yourself in the world is artha, your interest, your personal interest in the world. So that's a goal. Then there's kama, or which literally means desire. The idea that we not only cultivate virtue and not only try to get what we need in the world, but we also have certain desires. You know, we want our pleasures. So the pursuit of pleasure is also a sort of an unavoidable human purpose. And then finally, moksha. The idea being that if you've been virtuous and you've sort of been prosperous, you got your pleasure in life, and then you figure out that actually, I don't know if I want to see this movie again. Like, you know, reincarnate and keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. Like, I don't know how many times I want to watch the same movie with just slight variations in the plot. And therefore, you may want liberation. Like, I want to go beyond this universe to a higher world, to a spiritual world, where I don't have to keep taking birth and dying, and basically operating within these limitations. There's just certain limitations for souls that have material bodies. It's not an infinite life. It's not an unlimited life. There is a massive amount of ignorance in the world, and there's suffering. Even if you sort of follow the rules and get a lot of good karma, inevitably in this world there's birth, which is an unusual thing, to be kind of trapped in the trunk of a mother for, you know, several months. And then you finally come out, and then you age, there are diseases and injuries, you finally die. And this is true throughout the material universe. There's also the notion of, I didn't write it here, energy conservation, didn't want to use up all their chalk, but there's a very popular notion found throughout these Indian systems, which is Triloka, the three worlds. The idea, just as in this world, there's upper class, middle class, and lower class. So in the universe, there is like cosmic upper class, middle class, and lower class. You can elevate yourself by good karma to higher worlds, which are called Swarga, often heaven, material heaven. There are the earthly regions, like good old Earth here. And then there are miserable, even more miserable places on Earth, sort of hellish worlds, which are not eternal, but they're just really bad places to be for people that have exceptionally bad karma. So the idea is that there, just as in this world, you can observe these three levels, so also on a universal scale. The idea of moksha is that even if you have the best karma in the world, inevitably you are stuck in the material world. Just like, for example, if you're in a penitentiary, which I don't wish on any of you, but if someone's in a penitentiary, even if you have like the best cell in the place, and you have library privileges, and you know, you get an extra donut for breakfast or something, you're still in jail. And so the idea here is that being in a material body and having to go through cycles of birth and death, old age and disease, and having just to deal with this karma thing all the time is not a great deal. And so moksha, the final goal of human life, is to free oneself from this and reach an eternal place. Now, exactly where do you go when you get liberation? That is really the debating point. That's really what the different systems argued about. For example, Buddhists. And Buddhism is not one thing, as we'll find out. There's lots of different Buddhisms. And so different Buddhist schools have different ideas about where you go. Like, what's the best possible destination the next time you want to travel to the eternal place? So there's Buddhism, different kinds of Buddhism has different ideas of where you go, different definitions of nirvana. Similarly, within the Hindu fold, there are different ideas about, do you go to a place where you're an eternal person? Do you go to a place where you sacrifice your individual existence and merge into a type of corporate cognitive radiance? The Jains, there's also a Jain religion, which at one time was actually a major contender. Nowadays, there's not too many in India. There's about, I forget the number, it's 6 million or something, out of over 1 billion people in India. It used to be actually a real contender. At one time, it was neck to neck, head to head with Buddhism. It was actually as important as Buddhism for several centuries. And then for reasons we'll discuss, Buddhism, you know, pulled into the lead and Jainism lost a lot of ground. But they have their own idea of moksha, of liberation. Everybody's got an idea of liberation, and obviously what you think liberation is has a lot to do with what you think our real identity is as persons. Because after all, everyone has a sense of going back to your roots, or liberation being finding who you really are. And so based on what people thought, or still think, we are, they had different conceptions of where we should go. Yes?
In the text, you talked about moksha being like contrasted with
bhukti.
I don't know how to say it.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's fine.
Enjoyment of
world. Yeah, the word bhukti. There's
the... Like, how that goes with number three up there, which is also pleasure, but that's
right.
As a goal.
Yeah, bhukti is from the Sanskrit word bhuj, which means to enjoy. And then it's often another synonym, I mean another way to say mukti from the same Sanskrit root is moksha, is mukti. So mukti and moksha are exactly the same thing. Just different ways to form nouns from verbal roots in Sanskrit. So bhukti and mukti are contrasted. Yeah, exactly as you thought. Bhukti would sort of be this. I think the book gives somewhat of a false impression. Last semester I was kind of very hard on the book, and so I, you know, turned over a new leaf this year. But I do have to say that the book tends to have a somewhat, I would say, almost naive idea that because for each of these different purposes, there are scriptures, there are Dharma scriptures, Artha scriptures, Kama scriptures, Moksha scriptures, the idea being there were separate communities that only cared about this or that. But in fact, people in general did accept all four goals of life. And, but anyway, that wasn't too harsh. So, any questions on this so far? Yes.
Can you clarify real quick?
So sure.
Bhukti is just a synonym
For Kama, right, right. But of course, to get the good bhukti, you need the art, you need to pay for it. So. Yes?
Isn't bhukti like the pleasure after that, like for material heaven and stuff, and Kama is like pleasure in the world?
No, Kama, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, for example, chapter 9, describes those specifically go to Swarga heaven as Kama Kami, those who are engrossed in Kama. So it's a universal term for trying to enjoy the world, wherever you're trying to enjoy it. Wherever your favorite karma destination is. So, any other points on this? Questions? No? Going, gone. Yes?
You said corporate cosmic radiance. What do you mean by that?
Where you give up your individual existence and merge into some, like, one impersonal consciousness. Which means no more individual freedom, no more choices. It's just, you don't exist as an individual person. I find that a little unattractive, but we'll talk about it. I personally really like my freedom. So, let's see, where are we here? Okay, guna. There's another very important point, which or little list of items. It's a way of analyzing the world, and this little analysis really pervades Indian thinking in all the different schools. Everyone kind of takes this for granted. And that is that there are basically three qualities in the world. Just as we can measure the world in certain ways, quantify it, there are certain qualities in the world, qualities of consciousness, you could say. And these are sattva, goodness, rajas, that's an R, passion, and tamas, ignorance. And to give some simple examples, some music, let's say, tends to make you peaceful. It tends to make you peaceful or thoughtful. So that music might be the mode of goodness. Some music is very passionate, very passionate. Some music is just kind of like, well, you could say, in ignorance, in the sense that it kind of goes with irrational moods or violent moods or just sometimes another symptom of ignorance would be total inertia. Just like you can't get out of bed in the morning, you feel really miserable, you don't like anyone, you don't like yourself. One of those great moods. So that's ignorance. Passion is more characterized by ambition, pride, and so on. And goodness is virtue, peace. So, not only, let's say, music, food. Certain food, for example, food typically, in fact, the term is used, sattvika bhojana, food and goodness, food and sattva. The food that's obtained without undue violence, for example, fruits, vegetables, grains, foods that don't involve the slaughter of highly evolved mammals. In America, by the way, you can only kill highly evolved mammals if they're the kind that make good urban pets, like dogs and cats. That's a crime. But if a mammal with the same level of conscious development doesn't make a good urban pet, then, you know, do whatever you want. So anyway, foods which are obtained, let's say, without undue violence, and foods which tend to create a peaceful consciousness. Certain foods, you could say vegetarian, but they may be, let's say, extremely spicy, really hot, and so you're just like flaming after you eat that. Or certain foods are, let's say, rotten, or obtained with extreme violence, and so on. So that'd be food and ignorance. The idea is that music, food, different kinds of environments. I mean, if you're right in the middle of Manhattan, that's a bit passionate. Whereas, let's say you go out walking in the country, out in the hills, in a beautiful forest by a lake, that would be in goodness. If you're in a place where, let's say, people are kind of just like, I don't know, abusing each other, or it's just totally irrational and violent, that might be a place in ignorance. And so, the idea is that our consciousness, the way Krishna puts it in the Gita, I mention the Gita a lot because it's like the main book of Hinduism, but in the Gita, for example, there's one statement, guna guneshu vartante, that these gunas, these qualities are functioning within the qualities. So our consciousness and our body is composed of different qualities in addition to being composed of different physical elements. It's also, therefore, some people, let's say, who tend to be passionate, they'll be attracted to passionate music. They'll be attracted to passionate food. They'll be attracted, they'll make friendship with other passionate people. They'll want to live in a passionate place. Like they'll find, let's say, a place out in the country, unbearably boring. It's like, I hate this. You know, I want to get back in the city, but there's like neon signs and loud music playing and so on. And so on. So we are, in a sense, constantly recreating ourselves by all of our choice of friends, environment, music, food, everything, the kind of work we want to do. We are constantly reconstituting ourselves with these different qualities. And based on the final result, the time of death, how you recreated, reconstituted yourself qualitatively, to a great extent will determine where you go in your next life by the law of karma. Now, this also relates to another thing. This is all interrelated. Varna. I think in our textbook it says somewhat misleadingly that, the word varna means color, which it can mean. There's like 100 different meanings for the word varna. One of them is color. When the European colonialists, especially the British, were trying to justify their takeover of India, they promoted something which was not there before in India, which is that the idea of varna is the division of occupation, you know, Brahmins, the priestly and teacher class, Kshatriyas, warriors, Vaishyas, merchants and farmers, Shudras, laborers, but these were racial designations, that actually India was set up along racial lines, so that the lighter you were, the higher you were. Now, the English thought this was a great idea, because that's exactly what they were doing, but in fact, if you look at the tradition, that's not what people in Hinduism or in ancient Vedic culture were doing. The word varna also just means a social order. It also means just definition of something, a description of something. So this is not a racial designation. I wanted to make that point. But those who are primarily in sattva and goodness are Brahmins. That's the idea. If a person is primarily in goodness, so they value knowledge, what they're looking for in life is not just prestige, fame, profit, but actually wisdom. And they value a peaceful life over an agitated life, then that person is naturally a Brahmin. Because they're interested in knowledge, they're teachers and scholars. And then if someone is very passionate, they might be a warrior, because it's a very passionate thing to go around, you know, bopping people with clubs and swords and things. So, to be a warrior, one requires a lot of passion. And then it says someone who's sort of half passion, half ignorance, can become the head of a Great American Corporation. As we've seen, anyway, you all know what happened recently. And then a Shudra, the idea being someone who was in the lower modes and is sort of dependent, would be labor class. That was a general idea. So there are these four varnas, regarding, this gets into a larger topic, which is social hierarchy, because this system rigidified into a hereditary caste system, which is kind of like the notorious and much looked down upon hereditary caste system of India. And so I want to say a few words about that. One thing I wanted to say is that the original system was not absolutely rigid by birth. There was upward mobility and downward mobility. So the hereditary caste system where you're stuck, you know, however you're born, that's your karma, that's where God puts you, and you know, you're just going to stay there. There's no question of going up or down. That was a later corruption of the system. We should also understand that in Europe, in the Western world, in pre-industrial Europe, there was a hereditary caste system. America was kind of an unusual idea, although the original electoral college was only for major landowners, right? I mean, it wasn't for everybody, so, and it wasn't for all races. So social hierarchy is a thing which is hard to get around, and we'll talk more about that later, but you can see different movements within India, such as Buddhism or Jainism, or even certain movements within Vedic Hinduism, to try to abolish the caste system, to make a classless society, something that Marx wanted to do. And with always the same result, just as in communist countries like Russia or China, we found they developed this practically a more rigid hierarchy than in other places. So, and again, when people try to abolish class hierarchies, they just come roaring back, no matter what you do. And so that's an interesting question. Jesus, for example, rejected the types of oppressive hierarchies of his time, and yet Christian Europe developed very heavy hierarchies. So, Europe, of course, had a hereditary caste system. Practically every pre-industrial society in the world had a hereditary caste system. And that's a whole, I mean, that's a whole sociological topic. I don't know if we'll get around to it, but it involves just the reality of what it's like to live in pre-industrial societies where you have large extended families. Families are more or less like corporations. They're almost like little dynasties. And there's an incredible amount of social conservatism to marry within your community, within your vocation, and so on. And so those of us who were born in industrial, post-industrial societies, highly urbanized societies, egalitarian societies, we have to think our way back what it's like to take birth in a large extended family where different vocations are themselves, almost societies unto themselves, and families are communities unto themselves. And for example, everything in your house or apartment that you can plug in, there used to be a servant for. I mean, basically, everything we plug in, there used to be people that went around and lit the lantern because you didn't flick a switch and turn the lights on. There were no washing machines, no dryers. You didn't pick up your telephone. You needed people to take messages, wash clothes, plant crops, mend fences. The world is very, very, very different. And therefore, if you were a middle-class family, even, say, 200 years ago in the, say, the England described by Jane Austen, if you were a middle-class family, just respectable middle class family, you'd have at least like 5 or 6 servants. And that would be if you were kind of, you know, not upper middle class at all, just sort of getting by. You'd have 5 or 6 servants, and that means you'd need a larger house or different cottages around your house. What it meant was that your children were growing up with the children of the servants, and you didn't want them to intermarry because there were significant cultural differences. People spoke differently. It wasn't like nowadays where everybody kind of speaks the same English in America with certain variations and accents and so on. There were drastic differences in culture and language between different classes. And so you had to have these high barriers because the lower classes were actually living in your house. They didn't live in different neighborhoods. It's not like we live in a good neighborhood. The idea is that everybody was thrown together. So if you can think your way back to what it really felt like to live in a society like that, pre-industrial, it's a very, very, very different experience. And so you not only have your, let's say nowadays many families, parents are divorced. So it's not like your mother wants you to do this in life, or your father wants you to do that, and your mother and father only live together. And, or let's say if your parents do live together, then like they may gang up on you. This is what we want you to do. This is what we feel you should do. And that's enough pressure. Imagine if you've got like 70 people doing that. I mean, imagine if you live in a village and you can't just jump on a train or take a bus or get in your car or take a plane. Those things don't exist. And, you know, ox cars don't go real fast. So you're not going to go very far away from home unless you're totally radical and just renounce the world. And you've got like dozens and dozens of people. Your whole town is related to you, practically. And everybody wants you to do something. And if you don't, your whole world crashes. So there's this incredible conservatism and these types of social hierarchy. So in India, it played out like this. But if you look at practically every pre-industrial society, you'll find much more social hierarchy, much less upward mobility. Even in America, anyway, just get this out very quickly. But for example, I read in the Harvard Alumni magazine that they're doing this study at Harvard on social mobility. And what they found is, although we have kind of like this myth in America, there's like unlimited upward social mobility. Actually, there's not. And what they found is there's much less moving from one class to another than we like to imagine, and that the gap between, let's say, salaries of the rich and the poor now is the largest it's been in 80 years. And so we are, anyway, the social dynamics of this country are not exactly what we'd always want to think they are. Yes?
Do you mean that on acceptance by, like, the upper class are like on an occupational level, like people aren't able to move up occupationally, or people aren't able to move up being considered, you know, without being looked down on as new money, or whatever those, you know, opinions may be. Is that what they mean, or do they mean that just occupationally they can't?
I think they were looking at just where people end up. Okay. In terms of, now that's another interesting point I'll make. We are conditioned to think of upper class, middle class, and lower class essentially as economic terms. Mm-hmm. Like, let's say you invented the world's greatest toilet seat, mm-hmm. and you made hundreds of millions of dollars. your high class, or if you, let's say, made some music in which you like just scream profanities, but everyone likes the way you scream profanities, and so you're also now a multimillionaire. So you're also upper class. So in America, or increasingly, I mean, capitalism was not simply a free market system. There were free markets thousands of years ago all over the world. It's really the idea that your entire public definition is capital. The world didn't used to be that way. If you look at Europe, for example, before the French Revolution, before the Industrial Revolution, they didn't use those terms. The terms upper class, middle class, and lower class are modern terms. In Europe, they used to speak of estates, so that there was the first estate, the second estate, the third estate. The first estate was the clergy, the same as this, Brahmins. Europe had the same system, by the way. And Plato talks about the same system in the Republic. It's not just an Indian thing. The first estate was the clergy. The second estate was the nobility. That's what this is. The third estate was kind of like these two, the commoners. And so it wasn't about money. I mean, what you mentioned is, you know, was a very big thing in the 19th century, of course, in Europe, because you had the new money coming up and all this resentment. So, but up until this change in Europe, which is very recent, just a couple hundred years ago, it was not that they didn't use the terms upper class, middle class, lower class. They talk about estate. So if you were the first estate, you might be poor, and someone in the third estate might be rich, but you were still way above that. It's not like that now. There's no cultural component. There's no educational component attached to upper class. It's just money. If you have enough money, you're upper class, and that's the end of it. You live in a certain neighborhood, you drive a certain car, you go first class on airplanes, and that's all there is to say about it. So the world was very different back then. I'm not, at this point, justifying, recommending, or condemning anything. I'm just describing. And so India, we're talking about a world which is very much like this. The extent to which India is industrializing and urbanizing, this system is collapsing. So even the hereditary Indian caste system is gradually collapsing. The same reason it collapsed in Europe. Because that was Marx's whole point, by the way. This was the main... Marx was a very good historian, a terrible prophet. But Marx's main point was that the means of production determine social and political relations. So when people live basically in agrarian society and extended families and so on, you get certain kinds of social and political structures all over the world. So that's what we're talking about here. It's not just an Indian thing. There's no other questions on that? A few more minutes. Yes?
I have a question about the papers that you'd like us to turn in.
Oh, yes, please.
Like, what exactly are you looking for? Like, do you want
us
to summarize what we read, or do you want?
Okay, I'll say a word on that because I said in a letter I sent out that I would talk about it. We're going to basically look at Indian history. We're going to look at. I'm giving a lot of general things now, but at a certain point, we're going to go historically for the most part. And. So what I've done is, to make it simple, divided Indian history into two halves. And each half has its dialectical process. By dialectic, I mean the very simple sense. There's a thesis. In other words, things just are a certain way. This is just the way things are now, status quo. And then something else comes and challenges that status quo. Something challenges that status quo, opposes it. And then these two forces... tangle, you know, these two forces struggle with each other, and a third reality emerges, which is the result of the struggle between the two. It's like, I mean, imagine, for example, two rivers coming together, and then you get a third thing, you get a river which has the waters of both. And so the basic dialectic of the first part of Indian history is, I guess I'll just write a few, and we'll be talking about this a lot until you can't stand it anymore. So don't worry about it, but I'll just put it up once. The first stage is, you could say, the Vedic. That's when the word Veda, which means knowledge, this is the name of the ancient scriptures of India and Sanskrit, the oldest scriptures, the Vedas. From the Sanskrit root, how am I talking about this last time? The Sanskrit root, Vid, or Vit, which we get English words like vision, video. The Latin, Italian verb vedere, to see, German wissen, to know, the English word wit, as in dimwit, dim Veda. So, anyway, so there is an ancient Vedic culture, which existed thousands of years ago, based on the Vedas. And we're going to talk about that culture. what they were doing, what people were up to back then. And then what happened is this social system here became too rigid, it became oppressive, and people started to push back against what they perceived to be an oppressive social system. People were locked into this oppressive system. And the Brahmins, and the Kshatriyas, the warriors, were just sort of not being nice to everybody else, or just taking too much, all the good things for themselves. And so this pushing back, this cultural revolt against that, took two forms. One form was within the Vedic culture. And so we'll talk all about this, actually, so don't worry about it. Movements, different Shramana movements, in the Upanishad, people leaving the cities and going to the country, going to the wilderness, and meditating, and developing different systems of yoga, focusing on knowledge instead of ritual. So within the Vedic system, there was a more egalitarian, more knowledge-based, moksha-based movement. And then there were other people that just exited the Vedic system altogether. They just said, we're out of here. And you get groups like Buddhism and Jainism, who are probably the most famous. So you have this Vedic culture going on, doing their thing. Everybody's in the same culture. Then you get a reaction against it. And they struggle. And there's all kinds of debates. And then there's a real cultural battle going on. Both within the Vedic culture and with the Vedic culture and those outside of it. And then it all kind of gets resolved. There's a synthesis. There's a thesis, antithesis, and a synthesis where everybody starts to agree again. And so both sides kind of incorporate the best elements of the other side, and they come up with a new thing that everybody sort of is happy with. And that new thing that everybody's kind of happy with, you could call Hinduism. Just, I'm using words loosely, but that's basically what it is. So then everybody's happy again, okay? Because even the Buddhism, at least in India, it emerged out of Vedic or Hindu culture, and kind of ended up merging back in. So that by the time the Muslim invasion of India about 1,000 years ago, when the Muslims basically killed the Buddhist monks, not really the nicest thing to do, but anyway, at that time, Buddhism had practically become just another branch of Hinduism. Because of different historical forces we'll talk about. So again, let's say around 1,500 years ago, even 1,700 years ago, everybody's kind of on the same page again. There's a lot of diversity in India. There are different traditions, different approaches, but everyone's kind of getting along, and there are not real battles going on over doctrine and so on. Then something else. So that's the first half. The original Vedic culture, there's sort of the cultural revolt within the Vedic culture, in the form of people going to the forest and doing other things, and people leaving Vedic culture, becoming Jains and Buddhists, then it all synthesized into something like Hinduism, let's say approximately 1,500, 1,600, 1,700 years ago. Then it goes on for a while, and there's another antithesis. So that becomes a new, the synthesis becomes a new thesis. Then something else happens, and that is the Muslims invade in an extremely violent way. And so everything is just thrown up in the air again. So you have the existing culture, this invasion, this cultural battle, military battles, everything is sort of thrown up in the air. And over time, that kind of works itself out, and you get a new synthesis, which is just sort of starts to look something like modern India. So you have these two dialectics. So in the first half of the course, the paper, basically, what I wanted the students to do is just to at least describe this framework. Just, in other words, you can write the paper on any topic you like, sociological, psychological, political, cultural, mystical, anything, philosophical, basically anything you want. But just put it within this historical framework, that there's a Vedic culture, there's an antithesis, which is these new movements within and outside the Vedic culture, and then there's a synthesis at the end. Everybody kind of gets together again. So that's all it is. Yes?
You say that with time Buddhism kind of merged with Hinduism and it made kind of a modern Hinduism and like based on systems so that the whole system is not that rigid and stuff. But still if we see in India, but the caste system is still quite rigid. So
if you look at say cities like Bombay or Delhi, the more you find urbanization, modernization, westernization, the weaker it becomes.
No, but like you said that it merged long back with Buddhism.
Yes.
Buddhism merged long back with Buddhism, so like caste system shouldn't be that rigid from then.
Well, let me talk a little bit about the caste system, because I did want to talk about that. Okay, we have about 10 more minutes. First of all, for the caste system, the oldest book in Sanskrit, and the oldest book in this Vedic culture, the oldest book in India, and perhaps the oldest book in the world, was called the Rig Veda. Rig in Sanskrit means hymn, and Veda, knowledge of the hymns. It's a book of ancient, very ancient hymns in an ancient and now somewhat archaic form of Sanskrit. And so in the 10th book of the Rig Veda, it has 10 books. In the 10th book, there is what is called the Purusha Sukta. You know the word Purusha from over there. The hymn to the person. This is person with a capital P. It means God or the Supreme Person. And I'll read you, actually, a translation from this Rig Vedic hymn. When they divided Purusha into how many parts they apportioned him, what did they call his mouth, two arms and thighs and feet? His mouth became the Brahmanas, his arms were made into the warriors, his thighs the people, his feet from his feet the servants were born. In other words, the caste system actually comes from the body of God. There's the idea that God has created the world in this way. God has created this natural division. Just as God creates our physical body, with different organs and different limbs, so there is a social body, and this system is organic, it's natural. That's the idea. You also find this, by the way, in the New Testament, in a letter from Paul. And of course you find in the Bhagavad Gita also, where Krishna says that, speaking as God, that I have created the system of four varnas. But there is some mobility, it's not as rigid as it became later. And Krishna stresses in the Gita, in the last chapter, Sway Sway Karmani Abhira Dak Sang Siddhing Labhate Nara, that everyone in the system achieves the same spiritual perfection. Everyone achieves the same spiritual perfection. No one is spiritually better than anyone else. And that the system is based on your nature. In other words, it's not simply birth. It's not simply that you're born in a certain varna, but it's based on your own nature and the kind of work you were naturally inclined to. There's a story showing that there was some mobility in earlier Vedic culture. There's a very famous story called about Satyakama in the Upanishads. We'll talk about the Upanishads. Satyakama basically means something like truth lover. Satya means truth, and kama means one who desires. Satyakama was born at the very bottom of the Vedic social hierarchy. His mother was a prostitute. And so he was born out of wedlock to a prostitute, which in an extremely conservative religious society is bottoming out socially. So, but this boy was precocious and he wanted to study the Vedas. And this is in a society where only the Brahmins study the Vedas. And sometimes the Kshatriyas. They were very jealously guarded the study of the Vedas because there were all kinds of powers associated with the Vedas. So he told his mother, I'm going to go study the Vedas. So, what's my gotra? In other words, my last name. What's my lineage? Just like now, say you're applying to the University of Florida, the first box is last name. So in ancient India, that was the first box to fill in. You know, what's your last name? So when he asked his mother, she said, well, that's a good question, son. I'm not really sure who your father is. So since my name is Jabala, that was her name, you can tell people your name is Jaibali, which means the son of Jabala. So he went to this very famous, exalted Vedic guru, where only Brahmins were allowed, and he said, I'd like to study the Vedas and be a Brahmin. So what's your last name, kid? And he said, very honestly, without hiding anything, well, my mother doesn't know who my father is, because she was quite active in that area. And so she said, I'd call myself Jaibali, because her name is Jabala. So the guru said, because you're so honest, you're actually a Brahmin. Because you're so honest. And he was accepted and became actually one of the most famous Vedic Brahmins. So there was, that was the original system. And then, of course, things changed. Something else I wanted to rush through, and that is that the system in ancient times actually was not so oppressive. Here, one of the earliest descriptions we have of ancient India comes from a Greek ambassador named Megasthenes, who was a Greek ambassador about 2,300 years ago in Pataliputra, which was the capital of Imperial India at the time. And he wrote a book on India called Indica, on India. These are some of the things that Megasthenes says. This is one of the main sources we have for India thousands of years ago. The inhabitants have abundant means of subsistence. They exceed, in consequence, ordinary stature. In other words, they're rich, they're like large, healthy people, distinguished by their proud bearing. The law ordains that no one among them shall, under any circumstances, be a slave. But that enjoined, and of course, in Greece, ancient Greece and Rome, they had lots of slaves. No one shall be a slave, but that enjoined freedom, they shall respect the equal right to freedom which all possess. This is ancient India. The philosophers, being exempted from all public duties, are neither the masters nor the servants of others. In other words, philosophers don't have to fight like dogs and cats to get college tenure. If you're a real philosopher, they'll maintain you, so you can just think about things. The farmers are exempted from fighting. No military service for farmers. Very different from Europe. The farmers are exempted from fighting and other public services, devote the whole of their time to tillage, nor would an enemy coming to find a husbandman, a farmer, do him any harm. In other words, you don't attack other people's farms, you don't blow up other people's cities. Warfare is only among professional warriors in a designated place. No one bothers anybody else, and farmers are protected. Artisans, what about the artisans who are actually Shudras? They are not only exempted from paying taxes, but even receive maintenance from the royal government. Among Indians, officers are appointed to see that no foreigner is wronged. Should any foreigner lose health, they send physicians to attend them and take care of them otherwise. And if a foreigner dies, they bury him and deliver over such property as the foreigner leaves to his relatives. The judges also decide cases in which foreigners are concerned with the greatest care and come down sharply on those who take unfair advantage of foreigners. It's a very civilized society. Ashoka, who was the emperor about 2,300 years ago, he had these Dharma Mahamudras, these people who toured the empire to enforce regulations based on compassion to humans and animals alike. There were federal government agents that went around the kingdom making sure that no human being or animal was mistreated. There's another pilgrim around 1,600 years ago, Fa Xian, who was a Chinese Buddhist pilgrim, who spoke glowingly about how peaceful India was, noting the rarity of serious crime and the mildness of administration. It was possible, he stated, to travel from one end of the country to the other without a passport, and without any fear of molestation. This is a highly civilized country. Rich, civilized, there's freedom. The oldest text you find, like for example, in Mahabharata, there was freedom of speech. You could go out into the main square of the town and criticize the government, the king. And there's no hint of any punishment for that. It's a very interesting society. There's a whole history of what happened with different invasions and how the society was twisted and transformed by invasions and oppression. But when you look back at this ancient civilization, it's extremely impressive. It was philosophically brilliant, and we're going to talk about that. Anyway, there's other stuff I didn't get around to. I don't want to end late. So next week we'll start going into the details, the historical details of what this culture was and how it developed. So thank you very much. See you Wednesday.